the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
We don't get any money from Goldman or Sachs, but we get great financial support from James DeSisto, Marilyn Ryan, Steve Wozenski, and Faith Peoples. You can join them at peterbcollins.com.
As I was walking over the highway, I saw above me and in the skyway. I saw below me a golden valley. Yeah, this land was made for you and me.
In our second segment of today's podcast, Joby Warrick, the national security correspondent for the Washington Post, will join us. His new book is called The Triple Agent, about the remarkable event in Khost, Afghanistan, December 30th of 2009, where a Jordanian suicide bomber took out a group of CIA officers. Yes, this land is your land, Woody Guthrie sang, and so does Everclear. From California to the New York Islands and on the island of Manhattan, we are now in day 11 of the Occupy Wall Street protest. And I'm delighted to see this happening. I'm not delighted to see the police brutality, but many Americans are standing up and confronting the moneyed interests that have taken our country to the brink of disaster, then bailed out with our money. They paid themselves more bonuses and blithely go on with business as usual. Kevin Zeese returns to our program today. He is an activist on many fronts. He's an attorney. We last spoke to him on this podcast about Clarence Thomas's very serious conflicts of interest, and those issues remain in play. I know he's connected to velvetrevolution.us. And Kevin, if we asked you to name every activist group you've been active with, we'd be here for quite a while, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I'll just mention, too, though, it's our economy. It's our economy.us is working to democratize the economy. And comehomeamerica.us is working to bring everyone who opposes war and empire together to work together with a right wing or left wing, liberal, libertarian, progressive, or conservative. If you oppose empire, come to comehomeamerica.us and get involved. Then, of course, there's the October Project. We'll talk about that a little bit later.
And, Kevin, are you directly connected to the events on Wall Street over the last 10 days, 11 days?
I've been there, and I went to some of the assemblies where they planned the event. A lot of our core group members from October2011.org, which is the D.C. occupation, were part of the assemblies as well to help plan it and have been attending there regularly. So we have a big overlap, and we've endorsed them. They've endorsed us, and the movement is growing rapidly.
Well, and taking a page from Tunisia and to some extent Egypt and other scenes of the so-called Arab Spring, really people initially have had to work around the corporate media. And I've seen a lot of updates on Facebook, a lot of email and website activity, people passing videos of the shocking police activities. And it's really only in the past 4 or 5 days that the mainstream corporate media has started to at least acknowledge that protesters are there. Now, some of those media outlets report primarily on the skirmishes with police and then dismiss the protest itself, having barely mentioned it. But we are seeing that shift, and I have to give the big man from Flint, Michigan, Michael Moore, some credit. He was on Bill Maher's show last week. He went on Rachel Maddow. He went on CNN on the Piers Morgan Celebrity Gab Fest, and he really has been kind of cornering corporate media outlets into covering this very important protest.
No question. I'd say that the two things that really got the issue into the public media a bit, not as much as it should be, but at least a bit, have been the police abuse images that have become very powerful, and also Michael Moore, who has really brought attention to this wherever he gets a chance. He's on a book tour now, so he's doing a lot of media, and wherever he gets a chance, he mentions the occupations that are starting to develop all over the country. It's really quite something to see. The police, I think, really made a mistake in their abusive behavior on Saturday when about 80 people were arrested, some with very aggressive tactics. I think that really backfired on them. They've been much calmer since then, and that really brought front-page coverage in the New York Post, for example, in a very positive article in that paper, which is unusual. New York Times was forced to cover it. They didn't do a very good job, but at least they covered it. So, we're breaking through finally, and we have a long way to go so more Americans can learn that Americans are standing up and that we have the power to change things.
And, Kevin, it's sad the way the media works these days. It has taken the overreaction by the police. And allow me just to take us back to Chicago in 1968 when the police riot produced the violence on the streets of Chicago during the Democratic National Convention. And Boss Daley famously malapropped, "The police are here to preserve disorder." And it seems that at Wall Street, the police were there to generate disorder. And they've used what in the West and in the mountains we call a snow fence. But these plastic, vinyl, orange fencing materials that they basically use to create miniature corrals. And the description from the videos and from the written accounts really show that the cops have tried to corner people. They've given them conflicting information about whether they can go somewhere or not. And we have to single out Anthony Bologna, who wielded his pepper spray canister at two innocent women and a number of bystanders who got caught in the crossfire. They were, again, corralled behind one of these orange fences. And this guy Bologna came up, and he was distinct because he was wearing a white shirt, where most of the other cops on the street there were in blue uniforms. And one of the blues watched him pepper spray these innocent protesters and said, "Wow, I can't believe he did that." So,
that's right. I mean, if you really want to see this video, I think the best coverage of it was done by Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC. And we have it on the blog page of October2011.org. So if you go to that page, it's like the fourth or fifth story now. He really does a fantastic job, O'Donnell does, of describing the incidents and describing the misbehavior of police, not just in New York, but around the country, and how unfortunately common this is, and the lack of punishment that these officers receive. Now, the white shirts, by the way, mean that they are commanders. Mm-hmm. The blue shirts are the lower, the working class cops.
Yeah.
And there's an article in the blog I put up about the O'Donnell analysis. There's an article below his video by a woman who was pepper sprayed. She was not one of the targets. She just got hit. She was the third woman hit and just hit one eye, but it hurt. And she described what happened. She described how the blue shirts were fine, that they were doing their job, but the white shirts came in like animals and really became abusive. So it was the commanders who were the problem, not the grunts on the street. So it's a very interesting thing how that occurred. But it is, and it did draw a lot of attention, as it should have, and I think it's had a big reaction. The police have behaved much better after that incident.
And I understand that some of the cops have even expressed solidarity with the protesters.
That's the report. And we also have an article about that on the blog page of October2011.org. We basically, the reports were that more than 100 police stayed home in protest over the abusive behavior of their officers, their commanders. And I think, you know, that's what's always important to remember, that police are not a monolith. And when they see abuse like this, they know it undermines their reputation. They know it makes their job harder. And if they're good cops, they don't want to be associated with that. And so I think this kind of division between the police officers is important for us to recognize, and we should be letting these police know that when we advocate for a more egalitarian society, a more democratic economy, and a more democratic government, what we're advocating for will improve their lives as well, both personally and professionally. They deal with health care and pensions and salary problems. The D.C. police haven't gotten a raise because they can't get a raise and keep their health care. They have to pick. And then their families deal with these problems. And professionally, they'll be much better off in a more just society, a more egalitarian society. There'll be less crime. There'll be less violence. You'll have a much better situation for them, and they will have a much safer job to do, and they'll be treated better. So we are fighting not just for ourselves and our families, but for everybody in the United States. That includes the police, who are also abused in the system.
I think it's interesting to note, too, that on Sunday, September 25th, 60 Minutes broadcast a piece featuring Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly, who runs the police force in New York. And it was a big propaganda piece. They were talking about how things have changed since 9/11 and all the different techniques. And they've got this massive surveillance system where virtually all of Manhattan is monitored by cameras on a 24/7 basis. They have high-tech software that can identify people who are congregating. There are all kinds of toys and new systems that they have put into place, which make New York a wired Big Brother community. Kelly also couldn't resist telling CBS 60 Minutes that New York PD now has the capability of shooting down an errant airplane. And that's a very interesting development in its own. But the sum of this piece was a very effective infomercial for New York law enforcement. And I guess it was aimed at people they think are watching in caves in other parts of the world. But the message I came away with, Kevin, is that they're prepared to defend the moneyed interests of Wall Street. They're prepared to defend the rich and powerful in New York, the investment bankers and the people who really rule the world from there. And as they broadcast that message, they were hopefully keeping out of camera range the brutality visited on the protesters near Wall Street.
Well, you know, I think that the way that the media is covering the Wall Street protest is really a strong signal that we can't trust the media. They're essentially refusing to report reality. They are refusing to cover what Americans are doing for fear that more Americans will join the protests. And I just put an article up on our blog page a few minutes ago before I started talking with you about how we already know, so stop lying to us. And the more that they don't cover us, the more their credibility drops. According to a Pew poll done in the last few months, media credibility is already at an all-time low in the 20 to 29% range, depending on how you ask the question. And at the same time, their viewership is down, their readership is down. And while that's occurring, you're seeing the independent media, radio shows like yours and others, the blogosphere, the social network media, independent websites of nonprofit groups expanding dramatically. And so we're getting more and more viewers. And there were 1.5 million tweets the first 3 days of Occupy Wall Street. And that at the same time that the corporate media is not covering it. So that's a disconnect. People see the tweets, know what's going on, and then see it not being covered. And that just undermines the corporate media further. And the sad thing is, as they lose viewers and such, they become even more dependent on the corporations to fund them, and they become more biased in their coverage. And plus, they're very biased toward the government. We're already starting to see a drumbeat now of messages to us about Pakistan, and I think that may be the next war target. So we're already starting to see that drumbeat begin. We saw the drumbeat for war for Iraq with the New York Times putting out essentially Pentagon and Dick Cheney press releases. We saw the same thing with Libya. And so we see these kinds of propagandistic displays over and over again. I think more and more people are getting it. We essentially have Pravda, a much more sophisticated Pravda, a much more sophisticated Mubarak media, because it's, you know, seven corporations rather than just the government controlling it. But it's basically a propaganda system that's very sophisticated, but people are catching on.
Well, a couple of things I can't resist here, Kevin. A friend of mine who was covering the Soviet Union when it crumbled taught me the line that Izvestia and Pravda were the state media organs. And Pravda means truth, Izvestia means news. Do I have that correct, or is it reversed?
That's right.
And the old saw is that there's no Pravda in Izvestia, and there's no Izvestia in Pravda. The other I'd like to interject here is that my friend Steve Pizzo, who helped write the book about the financial scandals of the 1980s, the savings and loan looting scandals, he created the term financiopath, and he first applied it to Charlie Keating. But financiopath is a merger of financier and sociopath. And we have financiopaths who are on the loose and earning seven, in some cases, eight-figure incomes each year. And the Obama administration wants us to be satisfied with the conviction and jailing of Bernie Madoff and a few minor corrections under Dodd-Frank. But the dominant narrative coming from the right and fueled by the Koch brothers and Fox News is that government is bad, that we need less government, we need less regulation, and that Dodd-Frank is a job killer. And I think it's really important that the people who've assembled on Wall Street are, at least in part, demanding that their government take appropriate action and bring to justice those who stole our money, who risked private amounts and then forced us to socialize those losses by having the government and the taxpayers pick up the detritus from the gambling losses that they incurred.
Oh, there's no question. Most Americans see the thievery that's been going on, not just since the collapse of the economy and the bailout of Wall Street and the housing bubble they created and profited from, and now are really screwing up the lives of most Americans who are own their homes. It's a difficult situation for many. But it's been going on for longer than that. We've seen massive corporate welfare, massive cut to the tax requirements of the rich. We've seen wars for no purpose that enrich the military-industrial complex and the corporations that rebuild the countries we destroy and then give them access to their resources, especially oil. So people see this corruption is incredibly widespread. The myth of America is being shattered by reality that's so strong that the corporate media can't hide it, the politicians can't hide it, the public sees it, and they're angry. You know, this Occupy Wall Street now has turned into morphed into a nationwide movement. As you said, this is in 11 days now. Now we have a thing called Occupy Together. And there are occupations going on in 41 cities as of a couple of days ago. There's going to be a big occupation day on October 1st throughout the country. They're in Chicago, they're at the Federal Reserve. So different targets around the country. And then October 6th, you have our protest, which is October2011.org, which is probably the one that's been planned for the longest and developed the most. And that's going to be a significant protest in Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., bringing Tahrir Square in Egypt to Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. on the 6th, beginning on the 6th. We'll see how long we stay. And so this is just going to get bigger. This is getting bigger quickly, even without the media covering it. Now there's Occupy Together, which is nationwide already in 11 days. This is going to grow and be something that the American public is going to know a great deal about, and they're going to say, where did this come from? And they'll be surprised because the media is not covering it, but many Americans already know it exists, are getting involved and getting organized. We have an article about the Occupy Together movement on our website, also on the blog page. It's called The 99% Are Standing Up Everywhere. We are standing up against the 1%. We know there are 400 Americans in this country that have the wealth of 154 million of us. We know that the top 1% has wealth equal to 95% of us. We know we have been robbed for decades, and it's time to correct the balance sheet. And that's going to be a major transformation of the economy and the government because people are fed up.
Well, and Kevin, unfortunately, the frame that the corporate media uses is toxically infected with the corporate messages and the so-called Tea Party messages. And so they're going to frame this as a class war that was started by the people on Wall Street, the people, not the people in suits, the protesters. And I'm curious if you have any sense, because you're a smart strategist and messaging guy. How do we turn this around? Because they started the class war. They're winning the class war. They're using their wealth to steal even more from those who have less. And yet the framing of this message is that it's our fault.
Yeah, that's such a false framing. It's despicable. But you're right. We have more people arrested than show up at Tea Party protests, yet they get covered.
Yeah.
I mean, 80 arrests is a large Tea Party protest of 80 people. You know, if you have 10 Tea Partiers together, the corporate media will cover it because their message supports corporate power, reducing government, et cetera. But they're a minority. In fact, we have on our website also a series of polls that show that the people can rule better than the elites. And one of those polls shows that socialism is more popular than the Tea Party in the United States. So they are a minority group that gets a big spotlight on them. The solution is, unfortunately, not a short-term one. The solution is for us to do three things. One, build an independent political movement. And I think that this occupation effort, I know that we're playing in October 2011.org, that this is the beginning of building an independent movement, independent of the two political parties, challenging both political parties for their sellout of America. Second, we need independent media, and that's growing rapidly. If you look at our media page on October 2011, we talk about everyone who comes to our event needs to consider themselves the media. We all now have the ability to create media, and we all have the ability now to transmit media. We're all media outlets. Through our social networks, through our Facebook pages, through our blogs, through our email lists, each of us can reach thousands of people, and some can reach 10,000 people, and some can reach up more than 100,000 people. And by doing that, if we do that with intention, we will be bigger than the corporate media. The cable news networks, they get in the hundreds of thousands of viewers a night. Only a couple shows get over a million. A couple shows get under 100,000, but most are in the 100,000, low 100,000s range.
Mm-hmm.
We can do that ourselves. We can reach that many people. We can literally reach millions of people if we act with intention. So independent media is the second key ingredient. Out of those two, out of independent media and out of independent politics, will come a third thing, which is independent electoral politics. We need to have an independent electoral vehicle that can stand up and challenge the two parties. We need to be able to affect the outcome of political races. We need to begin to win political races, and we will do that if we do the three I's: independent movement, independent media, and independent electoral organizations. All three are possible. All three are already being worked on, and I think we're now at the point where we're soon going to reach the tipping point on all three of those areas.
And I want to encourage people to visit the website, October2011.org. I'll throw up a link in the show file at peterbcollins.com. But it's a simple site with a lot of powerful information. There is a travel board, so if you need help getting to Washington, D.C., I'm sure that you can find like-minded individuals in your area who are headed that way. And what else is on the site? There's state coordination.
We have a housing board. We have a blog page that's very active. We have discussion groups who are discussing all sorts of issues, not just political issues, but practical issues. We have 15 core issues we think Americans need to work on. And with those issues, what we see is committees forming that will work on solutions. And we're starting that discussion on the website. We're going to continue it at Freedom Plaza. At Freedom Plaza, we'll have those kind of committee meetings. We'll also have classes on various solutions, and then we'll have assemblies every night. We want people to leave Freedom Plaza when we finally do leave with a foundation on which to build an independent movement that we agree on. And secondly, we want them to leave with a sense of how to do civil resistance. And third, the ability to build an alternative economy so we can start to opt out of the crony capitalist economy. Those are the two key ingredients: resistance and refusal to cooperate. And that's what's going to weaken the corporate power that dominates our government and our lives. And so we need to work hard together to accomplish those ends.
And if you could, I don't want to project onto it or try to expand, but if there is a mission statement for October 2011, does it include ending the foreign wars?
Oh, no question. If you look at our pledge, which is why we people are coming, it talks about ending the wars and bringing those war dollars home to satisfy human needs. Our goal broadly is to end corporatism and militarism. So it's not just to end the current wars. And we're starting on the beginning of the 11th year of the war in Afghanistan, which is October 6th. So it's not just to end the Afghanistan war, it's to end militarism and to end corporatism. Those are our two big goals. And you'll see on the front page, we highlight seven issues, including ending the wars, which super majorities of Americans agree on, but that the government is doing the opposite. Mm-hmm. And so we're already there with the majority of American public. And what this all shows is the people can rule better than the elites. The people can rule better than the elites. We need to internalize that and be confident in that and understand that, because it's a critical ingredient for us to have that self-confidence that collectively we can run this country better than the elites. Now, looking at what the elites are doing, sending the economy off the cliff into collapse, getting us involved in war quagmires all over the world, it's not surprising we can rule better, but we really can. We know better as a collective group. We know better what to do with this country to get it on track.
And can I suggest some balsa wood airplanes to fly around Freedom Plaza as a protest against the drone strikes that have been expanded from Afghanistan and Pakistan, now into Yemen, now into Somalia, and the next front is the Mexican border, where we're going to support the Mexican government with drones and military deployments. This is a kind of militarism that has spun so far out of what we expected that many people are really caught by surprise, Kevin.
Well, there'll be some drone models on Freedom Plaza. People are bringing those, and I saw one of the affinity groups was talking about a drone action. So I think that's a topic that's on the top of a lot of people's minds. This droning of the world, the ringing Africa with drones, attacking Pakistan with drones, killing civilians robotically, has become really out of control under President Obama, who has dramatically expanded the drone activity to levels that we never would have expected. Now we're seeing cities starting to buy drones for intelligence purposes so they can fly little drones in neighborhoods to monitor what's going on.
Yeah, it is really insidious, and we need to stand up and say no and no more.
Right.
And to what extent do you expect elected officials from Washington will be impacted by the protests? Do you think that it will make a difference in some of the more activist, more liberal members of Congress, for example?
Well, we're not inviting members of Congress to this. This is not a politician's place. This is a people's place. And so when they will hear from us, it will be in resistance actions. There are people, affinity groups, talking about doing activities on Capitol Hill, doing protests up there, so they'll feel those. We think that the real effect will be a longer-term effect. We want to leave this with a foundation on which to build an independent movement, and as that movement builds and becomes a congressionally district-organized movement, members of Congress will know we're there. And so we're not going to let this kind of disorganization continue. We want to see an organized, independent movement that has its intention to impact not only the government, but also to democratize the economy. And that's a critical step of really getting control of our own lives.
And, Kevin, I'm looking right now at the subpage on the website marked Statement, where you have the pledge, and I want to read this briefly so that people understand what the focus is. I pledge that if any U.S. troops, contractors, or mercenaries remain in Afghanistan on Thursday, October 6, 2011, as that occupation goes into its 11th year, I will commit to being in Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. with others on that day, with the intention of making it our Tahrir Square, Cairo, our Madison, Wisconsin, where we will nonviolently resist the corporate machine to demand that our resources are invested in human needs and environmental protection instead of war and exploitation. We can do this together. We will be the beginning. And you're invited to take that pledge and add your signature on the website. There are prefab flyers that you can access here and either print or send to friends. There are all kinds of Facebook and Twitter links that you can utilize. If you're not able to be in Washington, there are discussion boards, and you have opportunities for people to join a committee on 15 core issues and also to sign a statement of solidarity with Egypt. So you cover a lot of different ways that people...
People can sign up whether they're coming or not. We want people to sign up to come. Of course, that's our goal. The bigger the crowd, the more powerful the impact, the stronger we'll be. So we really want people to come. But if you're not able to come, you can sign up to be part of the web community and then participate in all those discussion boards and such that, you just described.
And, Kevin, in addition to the drone protests that you just described, are there any other creative approaches that you know about that you'd like to mention at this point?
I'm not sure I want to mention them.
Okay.
But, yes, there are a whole range of people doing a lot of activities on various targets in Washington, D.C., and it's going to be a fun time. We're going to have some great music as well, all kind of political music to get us all riled and ready to move forward. There's going to be
non-violence
trainings. There'll be some great speakers. It's really going to be an exceptional event. People, you know, if you want to be part of a historic moment, this is one you don't want to miss. You want to be able to tell your children and grandchildren, your friends and your neighbors that you were there, because this is going to be a moment that will be remembered.
And I'm just guessing here, but Tom Morello, the former leader of Rage Against the Machine?
He had a conflict, so he couldn't make it, but he's supportive.
Great.
And, you know, I just talked to Michael Moore's person to see if he can make it down. We're not sure about that yet. Cornel West will be there. Chris Hedges, who's been involved in this from the beginning, and is one of our kind of our intellectual leaders, will be there. So it's going to be a fantastic mixture of people. We have the American 99ers Union, which is the unemployed union. We have poverty economic justice groups coming. We have homelessness groups coming. This is going to be an event that is going to be a cross-section of American culture. People are writing on the website why they will be there. There's some amazing stories from people that are just bring tears to your eyes. The American story right now is an insecure one, and people want to do something to change that, and this is an opportunity to do that.
Well, Kevin, I thank you for your activism, and as I was thinking about the many issues that you have advocated for, some people refer to folks like Chris Hedges and others as public intellectuals, and I consider you to be a public conscience, and I want to thank you for inserting yourself into so many important causes, and I don't know how you do it all. I really don't.
That's a very high compliment, Peter. I really respect your work. Whenever I do your show, it's always one of the best informed shows I do. You're a great host, and you really know the topic, so I really appreciate being on. So calling me that such a complimentary name, I really appreciate that. Thanks so much.
Well, don't burn out, and I'll be in touch with you. I won't be able to be in Washington myself, but I'll be monitoring events, and I'll cover it from here.
We'll have a live stream.
Yep, I'll be watching.
All right.
Okay, Kevin Zeese, and again, the website, October2011.org. In our second segment on the Peter B. Collins Show today, a Washington Post reporter has reconstructed the events of December 30th, 2009, in Khost, Afghanistan. It's called Triple Agents. Joby Warrick is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter at the Washington Post, where he covers national security. And he took about a year off to, as I say, reconstruct the events from Khost, Afghanistan. And his book is a powerful read called The Triple Agent, subtitled The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. Joby, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
It's a pleasure.
And what did you win the Pulitzer for, please?
It was for an investigative series that did it, the Raleigh, North Carolina newspaper back in the mid-90s. It had to do with factory farming and some environmental issues that we discovered during that time.
Uh-huh. Very interesting. And did you ever see the animated cartoon based on The Matrix about factory farming called The Matrix?
I think I did see that. I think my kid pointed it out to me. It's quite interesting.
It really is, yeah. But that's not what we're here to talk about. Your book is a powerful reconstruction of these events. And first, let me thank you for it, because this was an event. It happened during the holidays here in the United States, and it easily could have gotten lost. And I remember being intrigued by the incident and then the disclosure of the Jordanian suicide bomber and the history behind him. And so I just want to thank you first and foremost for delving into these issues, because I think it is a story that certainly, might have gotten a 60 Minutes report once or something like that, but it deserves the full exploration that you gave it.
Yeah, and I think just as being someone who worked on this story during that crazy week between Christmas and New Year's and just was fascinated from the beginning and then even more fascinated as I began to learn about how this happened. It's one of these things I just couldn't leave alone, and it became almost like an obsession until I was able to put together, the strands of how this worked out. And it was just, I was as curious, I think, as anyone, and perhaps more than most.
And the central figure here is Humam Khalil al-Balawi, a Jordanian medical doctor who became this suicide bomber. And you take us back to the origins of these events, and it starts with a blogger, and it was Humam Khalil al-Balawi, operating under an assumed name, Abu Duhana. Is that how you'd say it, the J?
I think it's actually Dujana.
Dujana al-Khorasani. And explain what the implications of that pen name are.
Yes, he's hearkening back to a Islamic hero from the very first century of the Islamic movement, and it's a man named Abu Dujana, who was a very colorful fighter at the right hand of Muhammad, and was known for being a kind of a showman. He loved hand-to-hand combat. He loved to dress up in a red scarf or headband and trot around in front of his enemies and to egg them on. And so this blogger, even though he's a fairly unassuming, quiet living doctor, had a bit of this flair as well. And so when he goes into the internet to write these secret blogs, he picks his pen name for himself, kind of showing his admiration for this Islamic hero. And Khorasani refers to Khorasan, which is the ancient name for what is now Afghanistan. So he identified with that part of the world even before he ended up, by unlikely circumstances, going there to fight jihad.
Now, I've read a lot of blog posts, but I have never read these. What kind of jihadi sentiments was he expressing in this blog? Was it a polite kind of rational set of arguments about wrongs that have been done to Islamic people? Or was it a more virulent kind of screed that really appealed to the more emotional aspects of people's attitudes?
He's a really interesting writer because he combined some of this, red meat that a lot of people who follow these radical blogs like to read. But he's a very modern man, very much a product of the 21st century, and someone who was educated and familiar with, the cultural icons of the West. So he managed to write this, what became a very appealing weekly blog that sort of brought in concepts such as cloning and fashion and toys and it just all kinds of just very common subjects that people could identify with, and would layer onto that this fairly radical militant message and urge people to take up jihad and not be cowed by the West or lulled into a comfortable existence. They should be out trying to do something for their faith. And eventually he decided that he had to put his, put his actions, out there as well.
And ultimately he traded the presumed sweatpants he was wearing while blogging for a suicide vest, and he did detonate it. But his path was not straight from the computer keyboard to a training camp in Pakistan. He was arrested by the Mukhabarat, the secret police in Jordan. And tell us what transpired when they found out about his blog posts and took him into custody.
Yes, this is somebody that might have gone on just writing this blog and no one would have ever heard of him. But he did get arrested. He was discovered, and there was a very complex process in which the Jordanians figured out that this blogger, that which they were all concerned about, was actually a doctor who was living under their nose. And he, once it was discovered, they brought him in for questioning, and it quickly became clear that this was not some hardened militant, and not even, as far as they could tell, someone who was directly affiliated with any of these terrorist organizations, but somebody who was just venting, but doing it in a very dangerous way, they thought. But they also saw someone who was potentially pliable, who could be reasoned with, and maybe brought around to taking a different side of the issue and maybe being helpful to them. They began, after they arrested him and had him in prison for a few days, they began to approach him and kind of prod him for ways that he might be helpful, perhaps as an informant.
And didn't they torture him during that incarceration?
One would have expected it. He's told his family, and he told friends that he was not physically tortured. They did some of the usual, torture light kinds of things. They blindfolded him. There was sleep deprivation. They wouldn't let him sleep for more than 2 hours, and they'd bring him in for another round of interrogation. So it was on the harsh end of things you might get at a police station that's twisting the rules a little bit. But more importantly for him was the pressure they could hold over him. He was a Palestinian ethnically. So there was they could take away his medical license, they could take away his family's passport, and they made all sorts of threats. And his story about it afterwards was that he was humiliated, and that was how they managed to get to him and break him, making him, sort of shaming him into coming around and sort of confessing and then offering to help them out.
And he didn't explicitly tell his parents or his wife what that humiliation came from, did he?
No, he was very private about it, but he was clearly very scarred by it, because after this happened, his life changed, his whole outlook changed. He had never been that religious before, at least outwardly, and after this happened, he began to be a daily, someone would go to daily prayers and would speak continuously about about God's calling for him and what he was going to try to do. And so this was definitely a turning point for him in many ways.
And you disclose in the book, The Triple Agent, Joby Warrick, that his wife was perhaps even more radical than he was.
Yes, he went abroad to go to medical school after going to college, and he went to Turkey, and he met a Turkish woman. And she was like him, kind of a middle-class background. Her father was a teacher, but she was very much of a radical bent. And so the two of them, when they got together, it seemed to be kind of magic. And they were both very, very shrill in their ideology. And as an illustration of that, they had two girls, and they named the first one after a Palestinian hijacker, and the second girl was named after the biographer for the Palestinian hijacker. Just gives you a flavor of how committed they were as a couple.
So after this incarceration, the humiliation, you call it torture light, and I bristle at that. It's either torture or it isn't.
Yeah.
And his minder was Ali bin Zayd, Z-E-I-D. And bin Zayd is he's got royal blood in the Jordanian country there, the Jordanian royal family. And he was a guy who was collaborating with the CIA. And that wasn't always popular in the Mukhabarat in Jordan. There were suspicions, right, between the spy agencies?
Yes. They work together very well on the surface, and they do a lot of things around the world together. But it's a very sensitive issue for the Jordanians, first of all, because they can't be seen, for terms of their own population as being all that close to Uncle Sam, even though Washington gives them billions of dollars to help run their operations. And so it's a delicate relationship. It's as far as the U.S. is concerned, it's critical because they have really good human intelligence. Their agents are all over the world, and they've got good penetration into some of these terrorist networks. So we need them as friends, and at the same time, we kind of can't be seen together is the way it works. So it's very delicate.
But to offer a comparison, there's more trust between the CIA and the Jordanian Secret Service than there is between the U.S. and the Pakistani ISI.
Absolutely. In fact, you could name quite another number of allies around the world that you'd think we'd be very close to, but there's more of a rivalry or some bad blood between intelligence agencies. But this is one where the chiefs get along well, and there's sort of daily cooperation among officers who chase terrorist groups around the world. So in that sense, they are close and they work well together.
So I'm going to try to compress the story here a little bit, but Balawi eventually is seen as having been flipped by the Jordanians, and this is the first way that he becomes a secret agent. We'll count to three along the way here. So then he manages to get to the rural parts of Pakistan in Waziristan and penetrates the inner circle of Baitullah Masood. This is quite remarkable.
It is, because if you think about it, here's someone with no background in spying at all. He's never been trained for this. And he's a Jordanian, which many people in that part of the world would view him as suspicious because of their known relationship with the U.S. The king is friendly with Israel. He's initially suspected, and he's also someone who could have very quickly been discovered out as a traitor or a spy, and then perhaps executed. So it's amazing that he got through it all, but he managed to talk his way into the Taliban's inner circle fairly quickly. Comes to them basically saying, "I was sent here to spy on you, but I'm really on the other side, and I'd love to be able to help you out." And he manages to persuade the Taliban that he's serious, and they begin to test him and to see what he's really up to.
And now we extend our second figure. He is now a double agent.
Exactly. And as far as the CIA is concerned, he's a double agent for them because he's inside. He's managed to get inside, the enemy, and he's reporting back. He's starting to do this fairly quickly and very impressively, bringing back information from that part of the world. But on the other hand, his true allegiances appear to be with Al-Qaeda the entire time.
In your book, you quote a comment attributed to Baitullah Masood shortly before he is killed by an American drone strike, saying that American drone strikes result in three or four new recruits appearing at his training camps on almost a regular basis. Talk a little bit about that, and to the extent you can, how did you get that comment?
Yeah, this is something he said publicly, boasts about this, and he was basically almost in a George W. Bush way, bring him on, because it was true that these drones are striking closer to home for the Taliban and making them more vulnerable in their own homeland than it ever happened before. But because of tribal code in that part of the world, if someone is killed, there's a obligation, not just a desire, but a blood obligation to try to get revenge for that death. And so when these missiles blow up and people die, it starts a process. People have to look for ways to strike back, and of course they're very angry about this too, not just in Waziristan, but throughout the country of Pakistan. When these missiles pop off, there's quite a bit of resentment against the fact that their sovereign space is being violated by another country.
Now, one of the confidence-building measures that Balawi used while he was infiltrating the Masood forces, the Taliban, was to call in an American airstrike. And he was able to relay signals, I guess, through his Jordanian contacts to the CIA, and then they actually followed through. Describe this, please.
Yeah, and this is something that's told to us by Taliban officials who it's part of the lore for Balawi, is the way he was tested and shown to be reliable, is that a drone strike was set up to kill this Taliban commander, Masood. And instead of Masood being in the car that was to be targeted, it was a trusted driver. And the CIA was given coordinates and descriptions, and sure enough, there was a missile strike, the car blew up, the driver was killed, and it was Balawi's way of proving that he was every bit as good as he said he was, and he had the ability to reach into the CIA and get them to do things.
And so that makes him a triple agent, and he has managed to win the confidence of these three disparate entities. And it appears that while there were some concerns at Forward Operating Base Chapman, and they did practice the routines of his arrival there, that there was a kind of misplaced trust, in this case, between the CIA and the Jordanians, about the reliability of Balawi.
Yes, because what Balawi started to do that made him so intriguing to everyone on our side was that he was not just reporting back low-level stuff and Taliban commanders and the results of drone strikes. That's the kind of things they were hoping to get from him. But he began to present them with evidence that was shocking in its quality. He was giving them video showing him, in the presence of senior Al-Qaeda leaders, and then he professed to be the position for the number two leader of Al-Qaeda, Ayman Zawahiri. And so this is getting everyone excited at CIA. It's getting the White House excited because they've been looking for this man now for 8 years. And so there's great interest in trying to arrange a meeting with this spy that no one has ever met on the American side and to set up some kind of strike against the top leadership of al-Qaeda. And that's why there was this rush to, you know, to get a meeting set up, to get him into a place where they could lay eyes on him and then give him a job to do, get him in a position where he could bring in this Zawahiri's head on a tray, in other words.
Now, from the point of view of Balawi and his handlers in al-Qaeda and the Taliban, was forward-based Chapman chosen because it's a place where drone strikes were commanded from, or was this just a kind of sequence of coincidences? Because you report in the book that Balawi did not actually want to come to Coast and was trying to wriggle out of it, but finally agreed to.
Exactly. And this was, it turned out it was almost by accident that the meeting happened to take place there. It was really probably beyond al-Qaeda's wildest dreams that they could get somebody into a secure CIA base. Their whole plan in the beginning was to try to lure Balawi's Jordanian handler, this man Ben Zayed, who was royal family, so he was just kind of a huge prize for them. And if they could lure him into Pakistan in the pretense of having a meeting, and then they could kidnap him, it would be a huge public relations coup. They could put him on trial on the internet. They could execute him, perhaps. They can thumb their noses at the Jordanian royal family. So that's what they were pushing for, and that's what Balawi was expecting to do. And this was potentially something he could have done and then survived. And then, but when it became apparent that the Jordanians weren't going to let that happen, and the CIA wasn't going to go to Pakistan, it became then a suicide mission by default. So Balawi is left with the one choice, which is to go to the CIA base, and he was going to do it with a bomb strapped on his chest.
And, Joby, in the book, you pay special attention to two CIA agents, Elizabeth Hansen, who was a targeter. She was in her 30s when she was killed in this incident at Coast. And also Jennifer Matthews, who had been promoted to station chief there, but it was her first posting in a combat situation. Talk a little bit about Matthews, who in the analysis after the attack took most of the blame for this event going sideways.
Yes, she was a controversial appointment. She was someone who, without question, was one of the real al-Qaeda experts within the CIA. She had been on bin Laden's trail since before 9/11, was one of the true believers, and we have to go after these people, we have to be very aggressive. But she had served her entire career either at Langley or, you know, in London. She'd been in their counterterrorism operations there. But she'd never been in a war zone, never served in Iraq or Afghanistan. And her first posting was at this frontline CIA base in eastern Afghanistan, a very dangerous place where she was going to have to do things she'd never done before, such as running informant meetings, worrying about physical security every day. And some of her critics, some officers who served with her, think this was, putting her in a place where she was destined to fail. But as just a matter of fate, she was the one who was in charge of the base, and she was the one who put together this plan for getting Balawi out of Pakistan into a CIA base and safely out again.
You also describe in the book that Jennifer Matthews had been on the list of those who were being investigated for the pre-9/11 intelligence failures. And this has become much more focused on recently because of the recent interviews with Ali Soufan and his recent book that was published over CIA redaction objections, and also an interview with Richard Clark that was recorded 2 years ago but released just before the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And in it, the allegations that surface are that the CIA did not disclose to the FBI, to Richard Clark and others at the White House, their knowledge of the Malaysian summit and of the visas and residency in the United States of Nawaz and al-Midhar, who became two of the 9/11 hijackers. And recently, it's been disclosed or exposed that Alfreda Frances Bukowski was also one of the individuals involved in that process of non-disclosure, and that she voluntarily went to visit the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah which Jennifer Matthews was presiding over. So can you draw any connections between Matthews and Bukowski and these pre-9/11 intelligence failures?
Well, there's a group of very, shall we say, strong personalities within the counterterrorism division, and you've named two of them. They were good friends. They worked together on these cases. And, you know, the list of people that the CIA's inspector general identified as being potentially deserving of a disciplinary review for their actions before 9/11 has never been published. But we know from, you know, multiple accounts that Jennifer Matthews had been on that list. And it was something that deeply concerned her because she felt quite the opposite. She'd been very aggressive in wanting these people chased down. But it is true that, a group of about 60 people at the CIA knew about this Malaysian summit, knew that a couple of individuals had gotten into the country, and yet somehow, despite all this, you know, this detailed knowledge, none of the information was passed on to the FBI or the State Department, where the names could have been added to watch list, or the FBI could have followed up on leads. And so when the CIA's own inspector general is looking back at the failures before 9/11, this is something that stood out, you know, head and shoulders above everything else, is something that the CIA had really dropped the ball on. And for Jennifer to be named as having been, you know, a party to this was something that troubled her deeply, and she spent years trying to overcome that stigma within the agency.
Mm-hmm. And are you aware of any intent to investigate these issues? Is the Post working on it in particular?
Well, it's we'd still love to get that list, and we tried at the time to get the names of the individuals. It was decided at a high level, this was back during the Bush administration when Porter Goss was CIA director, that these names would never be published as far as the CIA is concerned. And there's not much of a process for forcing the CIA to retreat from that decision. They've essentially made up their mind, and no one, and neither the Bush or the Obama administration has pushed for further disclosure. They'd like for this thing pretty much to be put to rest and forgotten about.
Well, and you write about Jennifer Matthews' concerns. She's still in London as Barack Obama is being sworn into office, and she's very concerned about investigations. That ain't going to happen, is it? This looking forward, not backward, has really exonerated any of the individuals who might have crossed the line or even just failed to do their jobs. There's going to be no accountability.
You know, it's amazing now that, you know, as you ask these questions, even though we've just had this 10th anniversary and everybody's been thinking about 9/11 again, there's nothing that makes officials here want to change the subject more quickly than those kinds of questions. I think it's the politicians and certainly the intelligence people would just rather see it go away, and there just doesn't seem to be much public interest either that we've detected. There's certainly pockets of it, but it's in terms of getting people excited and interested in this again, it's been a real struggle.
Well, you hit a pocket right here.
That's good to know.
Joby, I know you've got to run to another meeting. Let me just ask you about the sourcing of your book. You do explain in an epilogue or an endnote about the difficulty of reconstructing these events and using sources, some of whom can't even be identified. And in some of it, you go a little Woodward on us with a kind of omniscient approach and some of the quotes from Balawi, what's going through his mind as he gets ready to detonate his suicide vest. Talk a little bit about sources and how you were able to reconstruct these events.
Yeah, the fortunate thing for Balawi is that he was so prolific. He left us quite a bit of physical evidence about his state of mind and what he was thinking. He wrote obviously quite a lot before he was arrested, and even afterward when he was in Afghanistan, he wrote a number of articles and letters, some of which were briefly posted on the internet and then removed, you know, mysteriously, but they were very hard to find now. But I've got quite an archive of his writings and also videos, and I have, I think, 6 or 7, you know, very lengthy videos in which he was interviewed by others or did sort of a monologue by himself describing, you know, almost moment by moment what these incidents were like and what it was like to be imprisoned and what his thought process was. So in that sense, that was fairly easy to recreate. But also happened to have either myself or some colleagues that work with me in Pakistan access to a number of Taliban officials who met him and who talked to him and knew a lot about what he was like. The difficulty on the U.S. side is that, as you say, all this stuff is highly secret. The base was secret. The drone operations can't even be acknowledged publicly. And so you're in this tricky situation where you have officials who are very happy to talk about drones and talk about their actions and that sort of thing. You know, they can't even be identified as sources because they can't publicly acknowledge that the drone program even exists. And that gives you a flavor of why this is such a complicated thing to write about and to report on.
And one of the things you put into context is that the acceleration of drone operations did occur after this Coast incident. And prior to that, the Obama administration was using them increasingly as compared with Bush. But it really accelerated after after January of 2010.
Exactly. This was such a incredibly painful moment for the CIA because they'd lost so many officers. This hasn't happened to them in 25 years. There was a period of time in January and February of 2010 where the pace of strikes was unlike anything we've seen before or since. And the explanation given to me was that they had a number of targets that they had potentially on the table as places they could attack. And after this bombing took place, it was all the stops were off, and they just went after the Taliban and Al Qaeda with full force for several weeks. And of course, the tempo has continued since then too.
Joby Warrick of the Washington Post. His new book is The Triple Agent, subtitled "The Al Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA." Thank you, Joby.
Enjoyed it. Thank you, Peter.
And here's a special bonus for those of you who listened all the way to the end of this podcast. The publisher accidentally sent me an extra signed copy of Joby Warrick's The Triple Agent. And the third person who emails peter@peterbcollins.com with the title "The Triple Agent" in the subject line, I'm going to mail you the book. Be sure to include a mailing address with your email, and be sure to put "The Triple Agent" into the subject line. As I said, the third email that reaches peter@peterbcollins.com will get a free copy of this Triple Agent book. Thanks for listening, and share this with your friends. I'll be much obliged. Happy trails to you.
Happy trails to you until again. Happy trails.